All right, welcome to this class on music skills. I'm glad you come. You've come. Let's begin with prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for this opportunity. Please bless this workshop. Help us learn new skills and have good discussions here today. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. On the subject of music, especially for upper grades, you can grab some handouts there, ladies, on the table. I think we'll get them for you. So it's easy for me to get pretty idealistic. Music has been a hobby. When I was young, it was a big hobby. Now it's still a hobby that gets a lot less time. But it was easy to be idealistic. When I was a teacher, I started out idealistic and was pretty quickly brought down to earth. And so there's a lot of things you can do in your classrooms with music. You can teach. You could think that you're going to teach more advanced theory because our churches need more well-educated musicians, and on and on and on. That doesn't typically work out very well. You don't have enough time. You don't have support in your community, and on and on and on. So, you've probably heard the term minimums for mastery. So, in our Anabaptist community, what is the minimums for mastery in music for our graduating students? This is upper grade, so I'm assuming grades 6 through 10, 6 through 12, something like that. So, it would be interesting to have a discussion. I don't think we have time for that today, and for you all to comment on what you think those are. But I submit that there are four things, and they're on your handout there. I submit that our students need to be able to lead singing. They need to be reasonably proficient at sight reading. They need to have some level of music appreciation and have some skills at text evaluation or poetry evaluation. There's room for you here. You can grab a hand up. So I think those are the four things that for our, you know, music is such a big part of our Anabaptist community, and a cappella singing is such a huge part of it. We need to put students in a position to worship and lead worship in music. That's how all of us are used in our churches. So that's what I'm focusing on, is those four things. You can teach, if you're able to teach more than that or go more into more depth on any of those subjects or any others, bless you, do it. But that's the four main points that I think we all should be trying to accomplish. So, number one, how do you teach song leading? The fundamentals. So, music theory. And I'm not going to have a lot to say about that because probably there's some kind of a music curriculum at your school, or if there isn't, I've got a few examples here I'll show you in a minute. But you need to... There has to be a basis of general basic understanding of music theory before you can learn to beat time, blow the pitches, be able to read the music well enough to take selections, that kind of thing. So I don't have a lot more to say about that. There are a number of courses you can use. You've probably seen this one, the Expanded Practical Music Reader. I think it's been a long time since I bought this. CLE may sell this. Different Anabaptist bookstores do. This one, Rudiments of Music, is a very simple, short course that you could use in a school setting. I've used it. I used it at Cornerstone Bible School last year. This is published by CLE. It's pretty basic, but it gets you enough that you could teach your upper graders a bit of theory with it. If you want to go further, this is kind of a neat course that I use sometimes, or have used a little bit. It's called Alfred's Essentials of Music Theory. There's a couple different books, there's like a level two or something like that. And this is more in-depth than the Rudiments of Music course, and there's a lot of easy-to-understand illustrations. It would be a good resource for you as a teacher to have on your desk. So... CLE does have an old, it's not in the Sunrise edition, but it's the old music curriculum, which I'm not sure if it's the best, but it's a music curriculum you can use. There are some others out there that I'm not very familiar with. Whatever your school has in place, try to capitalize on that. If they don't have anything in place, I guess that's something you work out with your school board. So that's the first part. They've got to know the fundamentals. So then you get into the more interesting part of teaching song leading. So, of course, you need you, as a teacher, need to demonstrate good song leading to your students. And that applies just as much to you ladies as it does to the men. So the men get to stand up in front of church more than you all do, but that really doesn't excuse you from your responsibility to teach your students and demonstrate good song leading. So a lot of these things are common, but I'll go over them. Put them in your mind again. Confidence as a song leader. I used to tell my students, whether they were preparing for the program or whatever, that if you feel scared, you're going to get up and do something. If you feel scared, then you fake it. That's how you fake that you're not scared. And then eventually you start to feel less scared. So if song leading is not a strong point for you, you need to practice it. But understand that song leading is leading. It's leadership. And there's a lot of pitch blowers and time beaters that really aren't doing a lot of song leading. So that's something that you can work on if it's not a strong point for you. One of the ways to help you be confident is be okay with making a mistake. I've done some kind of ridiculous things in front of large congregations, and it happens. You go on. There's a man in my church that I respect for this. He is a very soft-spoken man. If you sit in front of him in church during singing, he does not sing loudly. He is not particularly musically inclined. He's just sort of average, not a big deal for him, but he participates in worship. But a change comes over him when he walks up to the front of the church to lead singing. He sings at about twice the volume that he usually does sitting in the bench. He starts the song confidently, and it seems out of character with him in all other cases. But when he is a song leader, he leads. When he's not a song leader, he quietly sings in his bench. And I think that he is a wonderful example of understanding his responsibility, taking care of it, even though it's not his natural inclination. There's a book that I don't have to show you. It's published by CLP, and it's called Beyond Beating Time. And I'll give you a couple of, or I think these are the six chapter titles or something. Number one, personal preparation. Number two, leading in worship. Number three, knowing your audience. Number four, choosing appropriate songs. Number five, tips for effective song leading. And number six, overcoming common obstacles. I've scanned that book. I haven't read it extensively. It's fairly simple, but it's aimed at the new or hesitant song leader to just help gain some skills. It might be a great thing for your upper graders. And you can, you know, you could study it together, put it on the bookshelf, they can read it in their spare time. You could teach classes out of it. You could do a lot of things. So anyway, that's one book specifically on this subject. As one thing that a high school teacher needs to be particularly aware of when you're singing, even just in your devotions or in picking music for programs, that kind of thing, you have to be aware of your students' voices. It's not fun for anybody if your boys whose voices are just changing and they're trying to sing tenor and you've got a song that's too high for them to sing. Fun for no one. Things like that you have to be aware of, or else you can quickly turn your students sour. You got to be quick to catch if a part is struggling. So maybe you've got three girls that are singing alto and they're not doing well on this song, and you keep practicing for the program and they're doing wrong every day. They lose momentum quickly. You've got to quickly pick up on that and solve that problem. So awareness. So to recap, confidence and awareness are two vital characteristics for you as a teacher in demonstrating good song leading. All right, another point about song leading is give plenty of growth opportunities. And there are so many ideas on things you can do, so I'm going to throw a bunch of them out there, and hopefully you can think of other things that are more applicable to your situation. If it works in your classroom, you need to stop blowing pitches. Get your students pitch pipes or do something and start calling on your students to blow your pitches. They need the practice. You probably don't. So you can put your pitch pipe away and they can fill that need for you. So a common thing, I'm sure you've done it when you're singing songs just in devotions or anything, everybody beats time all the time. That's just the rule. When we start a song, everybody's beating time. You can do that. talk to the students when you're singing, like, about what dynamics or what tempos should be used, and try different things. Experiment. Allow them to experiment and help them experiment. See what sounded nice, what didn't sound nice. Another thing to stop is kind of stop leading songs yourself. I didn't entirely do that when I was a teacher, but I did put a devotional committee in place in my classroom who planned the student devotions as well as the student song leaders. And so there was at least one morning of the week where I did nothing, basically. They did the song leading. And that was boys and girls. In that setting, you can use the girls just as effectively. Another thing you could do if you want to help them hone in on this idea of picking a song that goes along with a presentation. So the Sunday morning song leader, of course, is sitting there in the bench listening to the message, and he needs to do something. So if the pastor, oh, there's that kind of funny little paper that I don't have with me, but it said the gave all these examples, one of which is the pastor got up and preached about alcoholism and how all the alcohol should be thrown in the river. The song leader led the song "Shall We Gather at the River." So there, you've got to, song leaders have to avoid that kind of faux pas. So you could have a devotional, and you have a student assigned who's going to pick a song to go along with it, and that could be a part of your instruction program. Have students take selections. As they're gaining confidence, that can be very scary for a budding song leader in a congregation to take selections. He never knows what's going to get thrown at him. So give them that opportunity to gain that confidence in school. So another thing that helps a lot is make your expectations abundantly clear to your students about or of how to lead singing. On your handout, on the bottom right corner, is this little box that says song leading checklist. And this was from my class at Bible school last year. So they each had to lead a song for the class, and this was what I was grading them on. Did they smile? Did they give the song number twice? Did they blow the pitch loud enough? You've all heard song leaders that blow it so quietly that you can hardly hear it. And then I had been working on them with an intro beat, so one beat up, and then you start the song. Eye contact, scanning, don't just have your nose in your book, make connection with your audience. And then another thing we were working on was end definitively, make a nice cutoff of some kind. That's an idea. You could do anything you want, but students, at least when I was a teacher, students performed very well when they had a list of things. This is what's required of me. And then you can critique them off of that. You have something to go on, they have something to go on. So make your instructions clear. Then they'll learn more quickly. So another thing that I did when I was a teacher was evaluation. And we evaluated the student devotion person as well as the song leader on that morning each week. So there was peer review from the fellow students. We'd say, well, how did they do? Did you notice something they did really well? They'd say, well, yeah, I noticed that he did a really nice intro beat and or started, you know, whatever. Or I noticed he looked very pleasant when he got up there. You could critique the song selections as well, especially if they're giving a closing song for the devotional. Then you could talk about how did that apply? What led you to that song? You could have a little class discussion on that. You can, if you have more high schoolers and you want to go further, you can critique dynamics. You can critique the communication of the song leader with the students. How well were they communicating a change in tempo or a change in dynamic? All of those things you can tell them how to do and critique them on whether or not they did it. And if you want to, you can come up with some way to grade this. And you can go on their report cards. I mean, maybe that's not all up to you as the teacher. Maybe you get some board input on that. But it's an idea. You could make this something that they're actually working towards. Another idea for you, again, we're still on the song leading, concerning song leading, is try to create opportunities for your students to use their skills and knowledge. So work out something with your Sunday school superintendent or whoever plans the Sunday evening programs at your church, and work out a rotation where your students are weekly leading singing in the church services. Then they get real life experience. I think that'd be a great idea. I never did that, but I think it would work really well. Probably your schools get together and the whole school sings together one morning a week or something. Well, put your high school boys out there directing that. You can sometimes, but put them to work there. Here's an idea you might think is interesting. Is there some way you could incorporate song leading or an explanation of the finer points of song leading into a school program? I think that's a weakness of our school programs often, is that they have nothing to do with what we did all school year. We get up and we sing songs and we recite poems, and it doesn't have a connection to the math and the language and the geometry and all the stuff that we did. So as a school board member, I encourage my teachers to do something that connects, some educational things. So there's been things about birds and different things like that. This is a way to connect. You can have them demonstrate this list or talk about the song leading checklist. This is what song leaders should do. It's an idea. And then also you could have, if you have a particularly competent student, maybe have him direct part of the program. And that would be a way to motivate him a little more. I'm going to move on. I'll hope to have open it up for comments for you later on, but I feel like we're going to have to keep pushing on. So, second point, how do you teach sight singing? Well, that's a lot of fun. Sight singing has come pretty easily for me, so it's kind of fun to teach it. It would probably not be quite as much fun if it was super hard. There's some good resources. So I got a couple for you that are with me. I don't know how many of you have seen this book. It's sold by Christian. I don't know if it's Easter Midnight Publications put this one out. So this one is fascinating, called Praise and Practice, because it was a bunch of these exercises are taken from an old music reader, and I don't remember what it's called. I think I actually have the old music reader on my shelf at home. That's an antique. But this is a lot of good stuff. They're anything from just simple stuff without any words. It's just simple drills. And then there's this little thing where it has five notes here, and that dictates the level of difficulty. So it's easy to tell if you've got a difficult one or an easy one. And there are songs back here, just a lot of that old music school drill stuff that you used to have to look for in books like this. This was, I don't know if this exact book, but this text was something my grandfather used a lot in singing schools that he taught. And it's a lovely little book, but it doesn't have as much material as that new Praise and Practice. So this is a book you might want to pick up off of Amazon. This one can be a little pricey because there's probably a new edition by now. I bought this when I was going to a month-long music training thing. It's called Progressive Sight Singing. And this thing has enough difficulty level in it to make your head explode. So if you get to the back pages back here, you start wondering how any human can process those exercises. But there's a lot of interesting things. This one does teach melodic sight reading, but for me, one of the uses I've used it mostly is rhythm. So here's a whole page of exercises, and I realize it's kind of small, but it's just a single line. There's no staff, so it's not a tonal thing. It would be a monotone if you used a tone. But you can sing these, you can tap them, and the difficulty level goes way up the chart if you want to get clear back in the back of the book. So there's fascinating things you can do here. So you can take it one line at a time. Then there's some of these that are canons or rounds. So have you ever tried a purely rhythm round? It is quite difficult because it's really hard. There's not many clues to pick up where the other part is, so you know whether you're on. You just have to stick with it. And so you can do the tapping rounds. There's other ones in here, and you could do it with any of these, but there's some of them specifically set up where there's two lines, and it's a two-handed thing, so you're reading two different rhythms. You've got the top line for your right hand, the bottom line for your left hand, and so you're reading that. And some of the simple ones are all right, and then you can really burst your brain on some of the more difficult ones. So this is a book I have. I don't know, and I use it because I have it. I don't know if there's a more simpler presentation of the same kind of material or not, but it's called Progressive Sight Singing, and there is a ton of stuff you can use in there for teaching rhythm, particularly sight reading rhythm. So, of course, scales are something that's interesting to do, and you can work those into all kinds of unexpected places. I think I heard of a teacher that her practice was you come in from recess, you stand by your desk, and we sing scales for 2 minutes, and then we go to story or whatever. You can work in those kind of things. Maybe you can find little scale exercises, like from that praise and practice book, and memorize them, and then they get worked into the middle of the afternoon when people are nearly falling asleep. Stand up, we're going to do two exercises, sit back down, that kind of thing. You can work in. All right, continuing with how do you teach sight reading? Introduce new songs, of course. Give them the opportunity to read. So singing the notes, as you all know, is a big benefit. And so solfege, do, re, mi, fa, so, using those syllables is a very helpful thing. If your students are up to it, even go to singing the notes on all four parts at once. So that forces a lot of concentration because you're all saying different words. That forces them to lock into their own part pretty specifically, and yet they still can hear everybody else, kind of hear how the song goes, but it forces their concentration down a little more. I know of at least one teacher who did that on a program. They were singing the song, and then one verse, they just all sang the notes. So there again, there's another direct connection to your program from the material you're learning. Another thing that is helpful, this seems counterintuitive, but helpful to sight reading is play them a recording first. I remember one time I had this choral piece of music I wanted the students to sing, and I knew this was going to be a stretch to get them to sing this. So before they ever even tried, I gave them the sheet music, and I had my CD player there, and we played it, and they followed along quietly. I said, all right, now you can start humming along. We played it again. All right, you can hum along again. And by then they're starting to sing. And that same day we took for, I think it was grades 7 through 10, we took a pretty complicated choral piece and sang it the same day. Now, there was much polishing, but it didn't crash. So did that help them sight read? Well, yeah, I mean, they could hear it. So that made the aural visual connection a lot quicker. I don't know if we would ever accomplish that piece. But that's a good thing to do if I wouldn't have let them listen to it. That's a good way to boost the productivity a little bit on the sight reading. And then don't give up too easily. There's a fine line sometimes you really got, especially with teenagers, you've got to watch that attitude pretty closely. And you can push them to a certain point and say, nope, straighten up, you're going to do it. But if you overdo it, they're not going to enjoy this experience at all, and you're losing ground. So don't give up too easily, but know when you had better give up or come up with a new idea quickly. One fascinating thing I heard about a teacher, a method she used was assign songs as homework. And this was kind of middle grade level. They would get an assignment, I don't know how frequently, but a song that they had to go home and sing the notes themselves or to their parents or something, I'm not sure. And then I think they had to come back the next day and sing it to her. And the fruit of that was that we were having a men's singing event up there in Spokane, Washington, and the dad of two boys, at least one boy that day, from that classroom came to sing, and he brought his son with him. Now, the boy is small enough, his voice hasn't changed, he's standing in the first tenor section, and we were learning new music. I was singing in the first tenor section, too. We were learning new songs. And that little, he was like 10, 11 years old, was sight reading music nearly as well as the adults in the first tenor section. And I was amazed, and I told his dad, what's going on here? That's what's going on. Teacher was making them sing songs as homework. So that's really good idea. Maybe you can involve parents with it if there's that kind of support. You can say, go home, your parents are going to pick a song, and you're going to sing it to me tomorrow. Just that kind of thing. And now we get down to that subject of round notes. What are we going to do about those when it comes to sight singing? I think you need to introduce them, and I realize that probably the majority of you as teachers feel kind of uncomfortable with them yourself. But like I said, the majority of the world uses them, so we probably need to have a little bit of a grasp of how that works. You can use solfege syllables. In fact, that's very common with choirs to use the solfege syllables with the round notes. So you know which line or space do is on, then you ought to be able to figure out which note would be fa and so on. And that is a good kind of connection with what we know with the shape notes to the round notes. It will also force you and your students to read intervals much more than you ever did before. So a fourth or a fifth or a sixth, and what is a fourth or a fifth or a sixth when I sing it, you're going to learn that much more or much better with round notes than you probably will with shaped notes. And like I said, you're going to have to be prepared to explain why you're doing this, because they will ask you. This isn't what's in our hymn book. You know, if they want to join even the Anabaptist, go sing with pretty much any Anabaptist choir, they're going to be singing choral sheet music, and it will most likely be in round notes. So some exposure is going to be good. All right, I think that's all for how do you teach sight reading. How do you teach appreciation for music? Now, why do we need this in our churches? Why do we need our students to have at least some level of appreciation for music? Music is a big part of our worship services. And if our students are missing the fact that different tunes help us think different things, then that's a problem, because the words are important. The music's pretty important too. So how can we teach them to appreciate that? So one thing, I don't know if it's applicable to your school, maybe ruled against, but most of the time if you want to play recorded music in your classroom, that's fine. So within the standards of your community you're teaching in, listen to good music. And so as a being interested in music, I have opinions about what good music is, and I have opinions that tell me that a lot of Anabaptist people have too low a standard of music. And so there are Anabaptist people with great hearts who market CDs with great intentions, but they're not the best musicians. They sing a lot of gospel songs. They have their certain styles that they sing them. That catches the ear of other people, and they listen mostly to that kind of music, and the good music then does not seem appealing because we're bottom feeding. I said that's some of my opinions. So listen to good music. There's so much good hymns, good choral music that is available for you to listen to. So you can do some neat things to engage in appreciation. You play this neat song. Maybe it's O Healing River or something like that, Lloyd Kaufman's arrangement of that. And you listen to that and you say, that's a powerful song. And then a week later, you show up and you give them sheet music. And you're like, remember that song we listened to last week? Let's listen to that again. Follow along with the sheet music. And then you talk about why is it powerful. And what about the music helps me understand or feel the emotion of the words and helps me think about that? That kind of a thing, you can use those recordings to spark the curiosity and then take it from there. Try to listen to different styles of music. Listen to choral music. Listen to quartets. Listen to early American music. William Billings was a prolific early American composer and has a very raw and unfinished feeling compared to what we're often left with. A lot of open fifths, dos and sos with nothing in between. And so listen to that. There is an emotion, a raw emotion in that music that you don't find in something as nicely done as O Healing River. So listen to different kinds of music. Talk about what makes them different. Talk about what makes them appealing. Expose the students. And then let your students sing a wide variety of music as well. I kind of collect music, so I have a lot of hymnals from different denominations. And there are some great songs that we don't often sing that you'll find in Baptist, Lutheran, Mormon hymnals. I don't know if you knew it or not, Mormons write and have a lot of beautiful music, beautiful hymns. Now, of course, you've got to be on your guard because you're going to find songs like We Thank Thee, O God, for a Prophet. And you're not going to want to be singing that one in your school because that's a false prophet that they're singing about at that point. But there's plenty others that are doctrinally sound according to Scripture, and they're beautiful pieces. The Mormons have a rich musical heritage. So that's some great sources. And I have a couple hymnals. I'm going to probably talk about them a little more in my workshop tomorrow. I have a Christian Science hymnal. Now, that's a denomination that I don't know much about. It's doctrinally in left field a ways, I think. But in a bookstore, I saw the Christian Science hymnal. Well, I'll have a look at that, you know. So those kind of places, or those are great sources to find new music that helps broaden your student's perspective. Depending on what the gender distribution is in your class, do some women's music, do some men's music. There's great resources for that stuff, and just adds variety, expands their world. Choral music. I've got a few resources for you in the back of your handout here, down there in that little box that I clearly labeled resources. I don't know how many of you recognize the name Lyle Stutzman. He's an Anabaptist composer and arranger. And he has a website called blueskymusic.net. He has a lot of his own arrangements and own compositions there. He's easy to work with on copyright permissions. I use some of his music at Bible school. Yeah, he's a good guy to do business with. One of his specialties is he's taught music a lot in grade school levels, and he's arranged a lot of music in soprano and alto, or soprano, alto, and tenor, which caters to classrooms where boys' voices haven't changed yet. Some beautiful arrangements that you can sing with the whole school and that kind of thing. A lot of them are on his website, but I don't know if he has all of them there for sale and publication. So the other resource there, it's called the New Choral Music Group, is something that he's pretty involved in, but there are some other Anabaptist composers like Wendell Glick and I forget some of the other names. And it's a Google group that right there, and I copied and pasted the instructions from the Google group there. It says, if you know others who would like to be added to this list, please send their email addresses to lylestutzman@gmail.com. So if you want to get on this list, you write them an email and say, I heard about this, I'd like to get these emails. And it's maybe once a month, maybe not always, it's sporadic. But these composers will send out songs that they've recently arranged or did something with, and most of them are simpler, like more for congregational music, but there's quite a few that, especially Lyle, will put out there that are specifically for schools in those, you know, two to three part arrangements. And some of it is, I was looking through all the list of emails I've gotten over the last couple of years from them. There was a bunch of Christmas music. The one guy had sent out like three or four Christmas pieces, arrangements of some well-known carols. It's a great resource for schools. So, and Lyle is I think he would be fine if you would email him just personally at that email as well and say, I'm trying to put together a school program. This is our theme. Do you have any music to recommend for it? I think that he'd be happy to try to help you with that. And aside from that, still talking about choral music, just it's good practice to always keep an ear out for, you know, whatever the new CDs are coming around, your friends have, or whatever you listen to. If you spot a song that you like and you think you could do it, make sure that you don't lose track of that. Write it down and chase down the sheet music or something. Give it a try. Another resource that... got my pages mixed up here. So still, again, on the How to Teach Music Appreciation, another resource is this one. How many of you are subscribed to this magazine? Well, none of you are. Well, you'll need to be if you're interested in this. I shouldn't say none. There's a few of you. So this is published by Lamp and Light, and it comes out, I think, every quarter, something like that. And there's technical theory articles in here, so your students can engage in that if they want to. There's always song history stuff that is fascinating. Then my favorite part is the new song. They have new compositions that people submitted to them. That's in the middle in this article. There's quite a number of new compositions. Then back here is one, is a section called A Measure Unfinished, and that's where people send in potential hymn texts. And they publish them, and then people that get the magazine, if they want to write music to it, they can. And sometimes you'll see these texts show back up in the new song section a couple issues later with music set to them. There's been some... This Measure Unfinished thing has kind of restored my faith in Anabaptist poetry writing. There are some really good Anabaptist poetry writers. I had started to lose hope, but there are some really good ones out there. And then... There's a question and answer thing. This is kind of interesting. They have this anatomy of a hymn section, and they break down stuff about the text and about the music and like notice patterns in the music and things that are more scholarly than I can tell you about, but they do this. So this is a fantastic... I've got a couple of them. If you want to look at them afterward a little bit, you're welcome to. That would be a great thing to have on the shelf, and your students that are interested in music, they can go pull that off and read about it or read more stuff. How do you teach appreciation for music? You've got to love it yourself. You know, it's like anything. I was a bad science teacher because it's not my thing. My school board, we had this biology course from Abeka, and Abeka has this DVD series that is videos of doing all the experiments. That was the best experiments I have ever conducted. I am able to put a DVD in my computer and put it in front of my students. And this experiment always worked, and it was fantastic. That's how I can teach science. But I was a lot more enthused about music. So you have to deal with your own bent and inclination. But if you're really going to light up your students, you're going to have to be lit up yourself. I'm going to say again, don't overdo it. Engage with your hard music, but if you want your students to appreciate music, then you cannot beat them over the head with it. So you've got to rein yourself in sometimes, probably. And the other thing, another caution, we have to be aware of the music culture in the community you're teaching in. Because you can get crosswise quickly if you start going against that. I remember when I was a teacher, I wanted to introduce some secular songs. I don't have a problem with secular songs. Mockingbird Hill, or things. I don't remember what it was I was going to show them, but it was just a pleasant, like a nature song or something, but it wasn't about God. My students pushed back hard on that, and I dropped it, and we never tried it again. Other communities, it would have been totally different. But that was a thing with them. So you've got to be aware of that kind of thing. How do you teach the ability to interpret song text? I'm not getting the two T's there. Poetry is another hobby of mine. I don't write poetry, but I love reading good poetry. So let me give you, we're short on minutes here, but let me give you a really quick concept of why poetry is neat. In prose or stories or that kind of thing, the point is to expand something and describe it in great detail. Good poetry, especially in hymns, does the exact opposite. The poet tries to strip away anything that's unnecessary, leave you with the barest summary of the thought so that when you read it, you ponder for a while. That is how good poetry works. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more later. Poetry often links two very different things, and that's one of the ways they make you think, because they compare something vastly different with another. Think about this line, the song on the back of your handouts. Like a river, glorious is God's perfect peace. So you've got a river, a body of water compared to God's peace. Yeah, there's some similarities, but it's something physical compared with something spiritual. That's a comparison. I think it was in a Reader's Digest or something, I read a funny quote. I don't know if you'll think it's funny, but I thought it was very hilarious. It said, "We get it, poets. Things are like other things." And so they're pushing back on, you know, the super romantic poetry about, oh, like that song, you know, my love is like a red, red rose and all this stuff. And they're pushing back, but I thought that was funny.
Things are like other things. All right, so you can quit talking about it.
But that's how good a lot of good poetry is, it's a comparison. Bear in mind, when you're dealing with hymns particularly, I feel pretty strongly this way, that many good hymns were very likely truly God-inspired. We do not elevate them to the inspiration or the application of Scripture by no means. But nonetheless, we recognize that God moved in the hearts of men to write powerful poetry that speaks to our hearts in the range of emotions that we experience in life. So it is something to be treated with respect when it's a good hymn poem. Stimulating poetry appreciation. Prompt discussions with your students about what the song text says. Now, you'll notice on the back on the front of your thing, front of your handout, I have a little section called pondering prompts. And again, I used this in my class at Bible school last year. This is not an exhaustive list, but this was just a little one I gave my students to help them because we were evaluating a song text every day. So, summarize the poem's theme. Put it in, maybe in one word or maybe a sentence. So that forces you to crunch it all down. What was he actually trying to say? Look for allusions. This is fun. So an allusion to Scripture, to nature, to historical event. And then what data does that allusion help me understand? Or how does it add breadth to the message? I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. Look for repetition. This is just kind of a literature technique, but is there a word or a phrase or a concept? How does that repetition reinforce a point or something? And look for contrast. Between words or between uses of the same word, contrast between ideas, because not always, there isn't always something like something else. Sometimes it's not like something else, and that's a neat technique to note. All right, I think we're going to take, yeah, we've got a few minutes, that's good. So, Like a River Glorious here, what you see there is the song in a kind of a poor copy, and to the right of it is my notes from when I used this song as a text evaluation in my class at Bible school last year. So the day before I told them or given them this song, said this is what we're going to be looking at. You go, you use that pondering prompt thing. Come back with your thoughts tomorrow. I don't remember what all they said, but this was what I was prepared to share with them. Are there any scriptural allusions? Well, there is, and I wrote it there. In Isaiah it says, "For thus saith the Lord, behold, I will extend peace to her like a river." So maybe that's where the author of this text got that idea. So let's look at the verses. Verse 1, what does glorious modify? You've all sung it. Like a river glorious is God's perfect peace. What does glorious modify?
I could never get a hold of this person by calling yourself.
That's right. We thought it modified river, didn't you? That's how it's sung. But there's a comma there. So it's like a river, glorious is God's perfect peace. Well, that's a different spin. I never thought about that before. So now I got to sit down and think about that a little bit. Is a river glorious? How's that go? Peace is glorious. So if it's a comparison, like a river, peace is glorious. How's a river glorious? That's food for thought. How is a river overall victorious? Well, you tried to stop one recently? You'll have a problem with that. How is God's peace perfect, yet like a river growing fuller and deeper every day? See, poetry is like going down a hallway. It's narrow, but there's lots of doors. And you open this door and you look into the room, and there's lots to see there. And you look across the hall, you open another doorway. So just in that first phrase, or first two phrases, I've got enough to think about for an hour. That's good poetry. That is how we appreciate poetry. Poetry is not so much about what the actual words on the page say. It's much more about what it makes me think about and how it gets my wheels spinning. Okay, we'll keep going. Verse 2, just some literary things here. Let's see, it says, not a surge of worry, not a shade of care, not a blast of hurry. You can point that out as excellent writing. That's a super descriptive word. They could have used a lot more boring words to do that. But we've got some things to think about with a surge of worry and a blast of hurry. there's connotations with those words, isn't there? And verse 3. Every joy or trial falleth from above, traced up on our dial by the Son of Love. What is that talking about? I was an adult before I learned what that was talking about. It's a sundial. Now that's fascinating, because joy or sorrow, it says every joy or sorrow falleth from above, but it's indicated by a shadow. What's the connotation of shadow? So I can start to think about that God's direction in my life can be indicated by difficult times. Every joy or sorrow falleth from above, but it's traced by a shadow. See, that is why I am fascinated with poetry, those kind of thoughts. Holy is used twice, which is kind of neat there. They who trust him wholly find him wholly true. That's a good repetition. So then my summary sentence for this song is much less interesting than the text itself, but for those who trust him, God's peace is undeterred by trial or foe. So that is how one of the ways that I approach text appreciation. It's just thinking about it. And like I said before, it's not so much about what it says, but it's about how it makes you think. I've got one more book to show you quick before you go. This is called Abide With Me, A Photographic Journey Through Great British Hymns. And so another thing to help text appreciation is the history of the songs. And this is a really neat one because it has a bunch of neat pictures of the locations where the hymns were written and the stories about them. So the CLE sells this book. It's a good one to have for that. So in summary, I bring you back to what are the minimums for mastery for your students. Maybe for you, you value a few things a little differently than me, but we want our students to be useful in the kingdom and enable them to worship properly for themselves. And I think that is the main skills we need to be focusing on. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you.